Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock & Whitney Bank's Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to david.lundgren@hancockbank.com, and he'll take them at the end of the call. Today we have Chief Investment Officer John Portwood, and Investment Directors Greg Hileski, David Lundgren, Luther McDougall, and Jeff Tangus. With that, I'll pass it on to David, who will be the moderator.
Great. Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone, and welcome to this month's Economic Update Call. And given that we're at the start of a new year, we're going to kind of review 2013 and then give you our thoughts or outlook for 2014. And we want to start with the economy. And, John, I guess last month when we met, we talked about the third quarter. GDP was a bit stronger than anticipated. I think it was, came in at 4.1%. A lot of that was attributed to inventory building. And because of that, a lot of people believe that fourth quarter would be a little weaker. So far, you know, we're starting to see as economists come out with their estimates for the fourth quarter and moving into the first quarter 2014, I think people are becoming a little bit more optimistic. You know, you're seeing a lot more confidence amongst consumers. I think early indication on holiday sales, it was a pretty good season for retailers. So, I mean, is that the trend? Are we seeing potentially maybe a little momentum finally starting to build?
End of the year probably looks better than was originally anticipated. And I guess to talk about that, let me go back to third quarter just a bit. And Dave mentioned that the latest estimate revision for the third quarter GDP was about 4.1%, and about 1.7 percentage points of that was inventory building, which really tends to dissipate over time and should have, you know, basically, you know, a net zero effect on GDP in the long run. In fact, since 2006, if you look at the contribution from inventories based on the Bureau of Economic Analysis numbers, it was just about flat, just about zero, which is kind of what you would expect. You get the burst of inventory building and then, you know, the inventories are dissipated through final sales and so forth. But anyway, in the third quarter, real final sales came in about 2.4%, which had been increasing, you know, quarter by quarter through the year. And 2.4% is roughly equivalent to what the BEA thinks is probably the, you know, the bottom line potential for the U.S. economy. And some people at the Fed think that's probably a reasonable estimate as well. But in any case, the coincident information that we have going through the end of the year from the Chicago Index and a Philadelphia coincident index suggests that the year ended on a pretty strong note. We don't have, again, the December numbers, but if you look at the year-over-year numbers to go back and look at the longer-term trends that are in place through November, real GDP probably about 2% plus or minus, maybe about 1.9. Trailing 12 months, I guess, well, that's what I just gave you, trailing 12 months was about 1.9%. Nominal GDP, not adjusted for inflation, is still running about 3%, maybe about 3.5%, which is, you know, pretty low based on history. And again, getting back to real final sales, which are represented by real personal consumption expenditures, that's roughly 2% year over year. So, you know, at the present time, it looks like, you know, if you're going to make a guess about GDP going forward, you're probably going to have to say plus or minus 2%, somewhere in that range, I guess. Although, as we got to the end of the year, you did have some discussion going on between groups that looked at the overall global picture and said, well, we're probably in a synchronized global expansion, implying that, you know, maybe growth would be a lot better next year than it has been over the last few years. At the same time, you see a group of economists who are talking about secular stagnation and the great malaise, which I guess refers to the 2%, you know, plus or minus, you know, growth period we've been in you know, for a time. So when you look at these numbers, you have to say, well, you know, which is right? You know, are we going to have, you know, escape velocity and get back to something normal this year and have everything develop more, you know, optimistically after that? Or does the secular stagnation and the great malaise that some of these people talk about continue and possibly does that get worse? And this discussion really has been going on, I guess, for the past 4 years, you know, ever since the recovery began, and nothing has really changed. Each year people got pretty optimistic or more optimistic about the next year, and it never really came to pass. And, you know, it looks like maybe this year things might be a little bit better than they have been in the past, so we've always got some hope. However, unfortunately, the velocity of money, which measures the dynamism at work in the economy, is still dropping and it's very low. Credit creation here and in Europe isn't in any great shakes. In fact, total credit creation in the U.S. is running about 3.5 to 4% annualized. That's about half what it was in the decade prior to 2007. In Europe, you're looking at growth in bank lending, but there is no growth in bank lending in Europe. Year over year, bank lending in Europe is -2%. China is trying to clamp down on credit availability to try to, you know, alleviate some of the imbalances that are going on in their economy, and current estimates are suggesting Chinese growth may be about, you know, 6.5 or 7 this year compared to, you know, what was it, 8 or 9, I guess last year. So, you know, while the leading indicators here are positive and while leading indicators globally are a little better, you still have pockets where you're looking at a diminution in the rate of decline, you know, say less depressive conditions in Greece, Spain, Portugal, and so forth, you know, while you're looking at relatively, you know, minor upticks in some area, other areas in Europe. So putting it all together, it looks like you've probably got an overall global growth picture that's probably roughly equal to the 2013 experience. At least that's what the IMF is suggesting, you know, currently might be the case. But at least the leading indicators are positive, and at least the trend looks better than it did. It's just a matter of, you know, how exciting is it going to be? And right now there's not enough information out there to really believe that it's going to be significantly different, although it looks like we're still going to be probably the standout performer, I guess, from an economic standpoint.
Now I heard you say two camps, the greater global expansion camp or the secular stagnation and malaise camp.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you think it's going to be somewhere in between.
Somewhere in between. And it usually is. I mean, it's hard for us. If you look back at the recovery over the last 4 years, it's been 2%, maybe 2.3 or so when the fourth quarter comes in. And yes, that's lower than the 3 or better than 3 that we were used to in the past, certainly in the post-World War II experience. But it's still growth, and we seem to have done reasonably well, you know, over that period. So in my estimation, you know, talking about the great malaise and the secular stagnation is probably kind of overkill.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Great summary. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the stock market. Incredible year, really was, and we finished strong. Go ahead and talk about the month. For the month of December, the S&P 500 was up 2.5%, which, you know, for 2013, it seemed like every month was up about that amount. So really good, consistent growth throughout the year. For the year, S&P 500 finished up 32.4%, and that was the best year since 1997. Russell 2000, which is an index for small cap stocks, did even better, up 38.8%. So we had really good market breadth. A lot of stocks moved up 40-50%. It was really just truly an amazing year, and frankly not expected by many of us. From an international perspective, the U.S. market clearly was one of the best performing markets. The ACWI, or the All Country World Index ex-U.S., was up 15.9%, which is a good solid number, but pales in comparison to the 32.4 by the U.S. S&P 500. And when you break that down into developed versus emerging, developed did much better. The IFA, which was up 23.6%, so pretty solid year for international developed countries. I guess the real glaring weak spot was in emerging markets. Emerging market index actually finished negative, down 2.4%, so pretty big divergence, almost 35% between the emerging market index and the S&P 500, which is pretty significant. So that's kind of a review of 2013. And as far as our outlook is concerned, we thought we'd do something a little different for purposes of this call. And Greg and John, I don't know, you know, I've been in this business for a long time, and I'm kind of amazed at the amount of divergent views. You have a lot of people that are on the two extremes in, as far as the strategists that we follow. And we even have divergent views within our own group. You know, you have lots of people with different opinions, and I think that's healthy. It's good to have different thoughts when you're trying to position your firm and your clients' portfolios from a strategy standpoint. So what we thought we'd do today is we're going to have Greg make the bullish case for 2014, and then John's going to give us the bearish case for 2014, and then we're going to try and pull those two together. So, Greg, why don't you lead off for us and tell me why I should like stocks this year?
Well, I think, I mean, if you start looking at a number of things, GDP is picking up. You were looking at maybe 2.5% this year, 3% in 2015. You know, we look at PE ratios not only on a historical basis but also on a forward-looking. And forward-looking PEs tend to be overestimated, particularly by bottom-up strategists. But if you look at that forward, and again, the market's a discounting mechanism, so it's always looking ahead, so you kind of have to look at a forward PE in addition to a historical PE. Somewhere the truth probably lies between the two, but valuations aren't unreasonable on a forward basis. And historically, if you look at a low interest rate environment, it tends to support higher PEs. Jeremy Siegel, who's a professor at Wharton, did a study and suggests that there's considerable upside or multiple expansion available yet. I think, you know, for whatever reason, the market's up. If you want to talk about the liquidity-driven theory where the Fed is just pumping so much money and it's finding its way in, it does create a wealth effect, and I think we're seeing that in some of the consumption numbers. Consumption actually in the fourth quarter more than doubled in the third. And I think, again, if you look at consumption being almost two-thirds of GDP, that bodes well for GDP. Also, rising home prices, that again also provides, I think, a wealth effect to people. And so, you know, that again would put more money in the economy. And if you look at the capacity utilization numbers, that's how much factories are, you know, putting their capital to work. You're starting to see it, you know, it's hovering above average. So just as a kind of brief introduction, I think, you know, those are some positive aspects out there. Some of the other interesting statistics done by Bloomberg and Strategus, which is a research firm that we subscribe to, it looked at the breadth of companies that were up in previous years. And I think the data goes back to 1990. And I think, let's see, for last year, I think 427 companies increased. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. 427 companies increased in 2009. And when 402 stocks ended in 1997 higher and the S&P added 27% over the next 12 months. So again, kind of looking at these historical perspectives, when you've had broad-based gains in stocks, sometimes history repeats itself, and I think back in our November call, I said that when stocks were up more than 10% through October, history 82% of the time, November, December would be up. And again, in this case, history did repeat itself. The other thing was what we've run into, there's a theory called the Great Rotation, and that's when money moves out of bonds and into stocks. And I think we're seeing a lot of that right now. People seem to be more concerned about the rising interest rates than they do about the stock market declining. And again, looking at a study by Bloomberg, equity funds attracted more than $160 billion in 2013, the most since 2000. So again, bond funds here saw about $80 billion in withdrawals during that same time period. So regardless of the Fed, investors are voting with their dollars and moving into stocks. Now, you could argue that's the only game in town, and that certainly, you know, would also help push up PE multiples. And it's probably, you know, another factor. And again, like I said, you know, the PE's not grossly undervalued. I think in a previous call I had said that during 2013 we actually saw PE multiples gain by 20%. Again, looking at that forward multiple, it's probably hovering right around 15, 16 times earnings. But again, I think that the study that Jeremy Siegel of Wharton did, he kind of took out the extreme interest rate environments like the late 70s, early 1980s, because I think you could argue that we're probably not going to see that type of inflation, at least not over the next couple of years with it being as benign. But certainly higher multiples and the low interest rate environment, you could see the multiple PE multiples expand to, say, 19 times earnings. You know, once we cross 20 on that forward basis, you know, there's a situation where you start to get a little more concerned. But again, taking into account what the historical PE looks like, the one bothersome thing about last year, or I should say a positive thing, was that we didn't have a euro crisis. Over the past 3 years prior to 2013, we always had a big market correction or sell-off because something in spring would happen over in Europe and that would shake our market. And I think over the past year I had talked about a correction that would be healthy, you know, some kind of pullback or consolidation, and we didn't have that. So, you know, I think that's still in the back of my mind. But I think that's basically the case I would make, is that, you know, the stock market, regardless of whether you believe in that creating a wealth effect, rising housing, manufacturing seems to be improving, consumer confidence seems to be improving. Again, that should translate into, you know, better payroll employment, even though perhaps a lot of the jobs are part-time and don't pay as much. But I will say, shopping this Christmas, the malls were packed. I had a hard time finding a space sometimes, so somebody's doing some spending. But also that should increase corporate earnings. I think right now we're looking at 2014 estimates, which, again, are probably a little overly optimistic, but double about earnings growth than what we saw in 2013. And again, that should translate into better industrial production, capital expenditures, and ultimately GDP. If you look at the economic indicators, the economic index, I mean, manufacturing up in 2013, weekly claims for unemployment insurance improved, manufacturing new orders, consumer goods and materials were up in 2013, the ISM index was up in 2013. Manufacturing orders for non-defense goods up in 2013. Building permits for new private housing up in 2013. Obviously, stock prices were up. Interest rate spread, the 10-year treasury bonds less the Fed funds rate up. And average consumer expectations for business conditions were also up. So, you know, will this ultimately happen? Is this for sure? No, absolutely not. But I think there's enough positive factors and perhaps a return of confidence in the market and the economy, and I think we could have some follow-through.
Okay, great. Good summary, Greg. And John, I'm going to turn it over to you. Obviously, there's a lot of reasons to be cautious. heading into the year, especially coming off of a big year like we did in 2013. What is the bearish case? What is the things that concern you about the market right now?
Greg talked about the strength that's present, not only in market momentum, but, the economic, the general economic situation. And, you know, that all speaks to, fairly to the near-term picture. And we really can't find any problems with, market internals at this point. I mean, you know, breadth is still pretty good. We've had a couple of technical scares, if I can use that word without getting into a lot of detail, earlier this year that suggested we might be in the process of forming some kind of market top, but they kind of got repaired fairly quickly and the market moved on. But what I'm going to talk about now is not really focused so much on the near term, but on valuation as it, impacts future returns. And there is something that has occurred in recent months that does perhaps speak to what might happen next year. But a lot of what I talk about is going to be, more of what the longer-term picture is. And when you look at historical normalized measures of price earnings multiples, and I won't go into a lot of detail about, what each one of these measurements is, but in any case, when you look at these as a group, they suggest that the market is overvalued now. We were at the edge of overvaluation back in the summer. Based on these measurements, we're clearly overvalued now. And in aggregate, when you look at the forward, return picture for the market, generally at 5- and 10-year periods, you get fairly low numbers. I mean, anywhere from, say, 0 or slightly negative at 5 years to maybe, 5 or 6% numbers that at 10 years. And there's a fairly high correlation, although not perfect, between this data and what happens to the market subsequently. And here's why, these things tend to work fairly well in a longer-term sense, although you certainly can't use them as timing indicators. If you imagine an earnings per share trend growth of somewhere between 5 and 7% annualized in the long term, which is roughly where we've been, since for the last 100 years, and imagine a line fluctuating around that long-term trend where earnings will be strong for a period of years and then weak and then strong and then weak. And that, of course, engenders periods of optimism and pessimism in the market where the market swings far above, let's say, the long-term trend line in a period of optimism and then reverts to the mean and sometimes goes below the mean into periods of pessimism. And when you look at the market now, we appear to be somewhere, at the upper end of the range of optimism with, relatively poor returns suggested for the broad market going out about 10 years. Now, again, this doesn't really suggest that, it's a market timing opportunity because there's certainly, you certainly can't use this as a timing indicator, but it does suggest caution because the market is valued now, in a long-term sense, excessively, and probably there's not much cushion, if things go wrong. You have a policy mistake, something happens in Europe, you could get a fairly, it could impact the market in a big way. There is one, and thinking about next year, and again, this is just a guess, and I don't think the periods really coincide perfectly. Based on one model, the market hasn't been this overvalued since late 1968, early 1969, and that happened to be the time of the great garbage market in the go-go years, which is really a true mania. It's really probably much worse from a speculative standpoint than what we see today. But when you look at the string of valuation measurements that existed between the summer of 68 and March of 69 and projected the returns out 1 year, 3 year, and 5 year. Basically, you were lucky to get a flat return. Now, the thing, in case you don't know your market history, what followed that market in 1968-69 were, in this order, the 69-70 recession and bear market, which was the worst since 1937, and then 73-74, which was the worst since 1930. Now, you know, we're not necessarily projecting that will happen, and we have no idea whether we'll have a recession or not. So that period may be somewhat unique in terms of the reaction from the period of overvaluation that existed. But nevertheless, you know, that's another valuation model that suggests that stocks are probably vulnerable here, you know, unless things, you know, work out in a very favorable way. So the other thing to keep in mind, too, as I mentioned, the fact that the market swings between periods of optimism and pessimism from time to time. The risk-reward picture is different at different time periods, and the more the market goes up in the near term, the more it takes away from your long-term returns because, again, the long-term trend in earnings doesn't change that much. So, you know, you're only going to get a certain amount of cash flow and dividends from the future to discount to the present. And if they're overly discounted and the market's too expensive, then it makes sense that you're going to have lower returns going forward. But the bottom line is that the markets appear to be overvalued now by a lot of historic measurements. They're probably bubbly. I don't know if bubble is the correct word to use, but they're probably bubbly. There's a lot of speculation out there. And I think there's probably a certain amount of illiquidity in the markets that we need to be aware of. Margin debt as a percent of GDP is as high now as it was in 2007. Plus, we see evidence that a lot of leverage is being put on fixed income securities in various categories. You've got this risk parity portfolio management type of situation that's been around for a few years that utilizes leverage on fixed income securities. And we've seen some instances recently where a number of mutual fund companies have been offering 2X income mutual funds with the idea that they're going to use leverage to deliver more income and yield to investors. So all of this seems to be coming together, you know, valuation, a little bit too much speculation, suggesting that the market might be vulnerable if something goes wrong. And again, you know, we don't see any evidence of recession. There's nothing you can point to out there and say, oh, this is the catalyst. It's just that valuation looks a little bit stretched in here. I might mention two other instances that investors need to be aware of when they're thinking about their asset allocation and the market vulnerability. We've had two classic instances in the past of pretty severe market declines without any sort of economic problem. One was in 1962, and the apparent catalyst then was when President Kennedy attacked the steel companies and suggested we were going to have price controls on steel. If the steel companies didn't, you know, comply with his requests and lower prices on steel. This is another one of those, you know, ill-conceived, you know, government attempts to control prices. And the market dropped, I don't know, 35% in just a period of a month or so in response to that, and then recovered. In a year or so down the road, we were back in an uptrend. The other incident occurred in 1987. Some of you may be more familiar with the 1987 crash than others. You might have been young at the time, but you might have seen it happen. That was a case of where the market just got too expensive and interest rates rose a bit. And there were other factors involved, too. But that crash was quite severe. I think we had a 20% decline in one day, perhaps. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was pretty extreme. Again, no economic problems. You know, the market just got expensive and something happened, and you had a pretty severe decline. Again, both of those occurred from, you know, somewhat overvalued positions, more so in 87 than 62. But I just mentioned that just in case something does happen and something does go awry and the market takes a fall, if the economic situation is not, you know, terribly impacted, then it's just a temporary disruption and we'll move on. But in any case, you know, those are the risks that are present now. You know, overvaluation, too much speculation, and it just leaves the market a bit vulnerable.
Okay. Thank you, John. And you know, as you heard, obviously there's you know, a couple of divergent views, and I think you know, both John and Greg made some really good points, and that's what makes a market. And you know, from a firm perspective, when we're trying to put together asset allocation or strategy for client portfolios, We have a lot of different views and opinions. And I think, you know, the bottom line or the key takeaway is we've been reducing equities over the last, I guess, six, 8 months. And really, you know, kind of the function of a couple of things that John talked about, and it's really managing risk and potential vulnerability. But we still have exposure to stocks, and there's still opportunities within stocks. We're just trying to manage the overall risk of our client portfolio. So thank you guys for that. Jeff and Luther, if you guys would like to maybe kind of quickly review the bond market in 2013 and give us your thoughts for 2014, if you could.
All right. This is Luther, and I'll start with the review of last year. And I'll be as quick as possible, but there's important things we need to mention here. The first of which is, for the stock market, it was the best year since 1997. Unfortunately, for the bond market, it was the opposite. It was the worst year since 1994. Now, in the fixed income market, we don't get the kind of swings in the broad market averages that you get in the stock markets, but it was a negative year pretty much across the board. As an indication of what happened last year, I used the 10-year Treasury and kind of what happened there. We started the year with the yield on the 10-year at 1.8%. Through the first quarter of the year, it looked like the economy was once again slowing down a little bit, and rates dropped to about 1.6%. And then in May and June of last year, we had some more upbeat economic numbers, and that kind of pushed rates up to around from a 1.6 to a 2.2%. And then we had the Fed coming in saying they were going to begin tapering, or at least talked about it, and that really pushed rates up as everybody was concerned, and rates rose from 2.2 to 3%. And then, you know, this is the market. After rates got up to 3%, the Fed said, wait, well, you know, maybe we aren't going to taper. And rates went back down to about 2.5%. And then they came back and said, yep, we are going to taper. So rates went back up to 3%. So it was a fairly volatile year in the fixed income markets, but overall rates rose on the 10-year Treasury from a 180 to a 3%. We also saw increases on the shorter-term bonds, or not shorter, but intermediate-term bonds, with the 5-year up a full percent from a 0.75 to a 1.75. The 3-year rose from 35 to 75 basis points. The only thing that really didn't change last year were very short-term interest rates, as the Fed continues to keep the Fed funds in that 0 to 0.25% range. So you saw anything less than 1 year relatively unchanged throughout the course of the year. I'm going to go through this pretty quickly, but there were few places to hide last year in the fixed income market. On the taxable side, there was one bright spot, and that was high yield fixed income. The high yield or junk bond market, the broad average, had a return of a positive 7.44%, and that's the only positive on the entire board. We saw last year that the broad aggregate, as measured by the Barclays Capital U.S. Aggregate Index, which is all treasuries, agencies, corporates, and mortgages from 1 to 30 years, had a return of minus 2.02%. Now, remember, that includes the principal change and income. So the broad market averages were down 2%. The best performing sector in there actually turned out to be mortgages with a return of minus 1.4, followed by corporates at minus 2, and then the worst was treasuries at minus 2.75%. As you can imagine, most of the activity when the Fed starts to talk about tapering hits the treasury market first and hardest. So you saw the biggest declines there. If you look at the treasury market from an intermediate term basis, it was down 1%. Long treasuries from 10 to 20 years were down 12.5%, and longer the treasury plus the 20 plus years were down 13.8%. So a pretty rough year if you were in long bonds last year. Another spot that's relatively new in the market is taxable munis. And they didn't fare very well either. That's in large part due to some of the events that occurred in the municipal market. The taxable muni market had a return of minus 5.75%. So like I said earlier, there really weren't very many places to hide in the taxable fixed income market. The best place to have been was either very short or in very poor credit quality bonds. And the only place, like as I mentioned, with a positive return was in junk bonds. On the municipal side, you had the same thing. The municipal bond index was down 2.5%, and it kind of was across the board out from the very short term. You had some positives in there in the 1-3-5-year range, but that's about it. 10-year munis were down 2%, and where you got the biggest hit, just like in treasuries, was in long-term munis, which were down about 6%. So where on the taxable side, you wanted to be short and in junk. On the tax-exempt side, you wanted to be short but high quality. If you look at the returns on the tax-exempt bonds last year based upon credit quality, it is what we call a monotonic. The highest had the best return, and then as you go down the list from AAA to AA, single A, triple B, you get lower and lower and lower returns, where you had AAA bonds down about 1.5% and triple B bonds down about 8%. So you wanted to be short and high quality, which is kind of the opposite of where you wanted to be in taxable fixed income. That's kind of a microwave review to get it done quickly, but that's what happened last year in the fixed income market.
Thank you, Luther. All right, Jeff, you heard the review of 2013. What about 2014?
Well, Luther's points were spot on there. And ironically, the negative points actually add up to be positive points for this year, in that if you look back to 1980, based on the Barclays Aggregate Index, we've never had two negative years in a row. Doesn't mean it can't happen, but it just means that's one of the things that's in the favor of the bond market. We were down, the aggregate index was down about 2% last year. The worst year was 1994, down about 2.92. So, again, just the natural mechanism in the fixed income markets generally prevents you from having certainly two very negative years in a row. So in a way, that's a positive. But let me back up here, and in the keeping with John and Greg, kind of hit the positives and the negatives for the bond market looking ahead, and then kind of give you where we think bonds are going to end up. Starting with the negatives for the bond market, which would be positives on the economy, John touched on it. Generally speaking, the economy, the U.S. economy is improving, sluggish, but still improving. Generally speaking, historically speaking also, that would be a negative. The global economy is continuing to improve. Again, that would augur for higher rates. Employment looks like it's going to drop considerably this year again. We probably won't get to the 6% level, but we may get pretty close. So that again is something that will have a tendency to push rates higher. And then something that Greg talked about, which is the great rotation. You know, whether investors just decide that they have an appetite for more risk and decide that they want to liquidate bond funds and move into stock funds, to the extent that that becomes a reality, that certainly would be a negative for bonds. So those are some of the main things that I see that are forces that would be pushing rates up. But on the opposing side, on the good news side, we've had the Janet Yellen move into her position as the Fed chair here. So she's already come out and said she's an easy money person. She wants to see short rates stay lower longer. So easy money means lower rates, generally speaking. Inflation, which is probably the single largest factor when it comes to bonds, is literally non-existent. Matter of fact, you hear more people talking about deflation than inflation. We all see what's happening at the pump with energy prices, and that's a factor there. So inflation doesn't seem to be anywhere on the near-term horizon anyway. Another more technical factor, the yield curve steepness, the difference between a 2-year Treasury bond and a 10-year Treasury bond is basically at 14-year highs. So there are limitations as to how much difference there can be between a short-term and an intermediate or longer-term bond, like a 2-year versus a 10-year. And we're pushing up against historical highs there, going back to 2000. we've only been this high, I think, two other times. So that would tell us that it would be very difficult for 10-year rates to go up a great deal without shorter-term rates going up along with it. I talked about the negative returns in 2013 in the perverse way the markets work. That actually is a positive factor for 2014, given the fact that historically you don't get two negative years in a row. And you very rarely get negative years in the fixed income markets in general. If you go back to 1980, 31 out of 34 years have been positive returns. So we very rarely get negative returns in the fixed income markets. So that, again, bodes well for 2014. The U.S. Treasury is running smaller deficits. They'll be borrowing less money. That means less demand for money, which then would mean lower rates, generally speaking. And then probably John Portwood's favorite positive for the bond market is that it's almost universal negativity when you talk about bonds in the marketplace. Everybody agrees bonds are probably one of the worst places to be. It's just a question of when rates go up, and whenever that's the case, it's very difficult for the market to actually act out on those expectations. So that would be a positive for the bond market. So all in all, if I threw everything into the mix, I would say that you might see a tendency for rates to drift somewhat higher. We're not talking a lot, 0.25%, maybe a half a percentage point, up to 3.5%. If the economy really caught fire, but I'd say that's out on the tail someplace. The more likely scenario is just a general drifting higher very slowly in rates throughout this year, which puts you maybe somewhere at the end of the year 3.25% to 3.5% on the long end. And that would be my summary, Dave.
Okay, let me just throw something else in, since you were talking about returns, and whatnot. Thinking about long-term returns available from common stocks, and again, just looking at the market, different industries and sectors and whatnot, as we know from our experience, can do a lot better than the market, the overall market over a period of time, where stock prices exhibit a lot of volatility, and essentially the indices are relatively flat, such has been the case since the tech bubble bursting in 2000. But if you assume that the historic correlation between the valuation numbers we look at now are going to hold going forward, then you're looking at an expected return for the broad market of maybe, let's say, 5% going out 5 or 10 years. If that's the case, and you can buy a bond and get somewhere between 3 and 5, depending on what kind of bond you're buying, then it indicates that from a risk-return standpoint, having a balanced portfolio probably makes some sense, unless you really believe that stocks are going to deliver a significantly superior return over that time frame. Something else of interest, one of our research sources has an interesting chart and database. It goes back into the 1960s that measures the inflow into stock and bond funds, the inflow into common stock funds, I should say, domestic common stock funds, that eliminates capital gain distributions and reinvestments and dividend reinvestments. And this particular number turned negative. In other words, an outflow, it indicated an outflow of stocks on a year-over-year basis in late 2007. So the idea that people might have been selling stocks and buying bonds at the bottom of the market in 2008 is not really correct. The movement out of stocks and into bonds actually began prior to the end of 2007. So a lot of that money could be, and by the way, it's still year over year, you're still looking at a net outflow from stocks based on this particular measurement, but it could be that a lot of this money, that is in bonds and has been in bonds for a long time, probably is going to, come out of bonds only reluctantly. Another thing to think about from that standpoint is that And I was just thinking about this when I saw a headline the other day, and then in one of the media reports it said, you know, investors have been selling bonds, you know, since 2007, and they missed out on the recovery from 2009 to the present. Well, if somebody, this is just an if situation and a hypothetical thing, but if someone sold stocks and bought bonds in December of 2007, their return based on the aggregate is something like 5% annualized to date compared to only 1% for stocks. So somebody that's been in bonds or largely in bonds since 2007 has basically exceeded the return on common stocks based on the market index, and they avoided the 50% drawdown. So I'm not so sure that everybody out there that's in bonds and has been tracking their portfolio return is necessarily so disturbed at this point that they're going to rotate into stocks. So it's just something else to, you know, to think about as we consider the bond stock relationship. And again, as Jeff and Luther said, you know, bond returns varying from say minus two to plus seven. I mean, that's hardly a disastrous year for bonds. You know, it's not great and not as good as stocks, but hardly disastrous. So, you know, in my opinion, bonds still offer, you know, a pretty good balance and risk reduction factor as far as, you know, overall investor portfolios are concerned. So just something I think everybody ought to keep in mind before they decide to go, you know, all one way or the other.
All right. I think we'll end it there. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And hopefully we have a great 2014 and look forward to talking to you next month.